Rise of the Atomic Age has been that when Trinity, the first A-bomb, was exploded in the New Mexico desert on July 16, 1945, the impacted area was uninhabited, so no one was harmed. But then you hear from someone whose family was among hundreds, if not thousands, who lived for generations near the test site. And based on years of scientific research, she tells you,
we know now that people in New Mexico were exposed to somewhere between 10 and 100 times more radiation than anyone ever has been from any other nuclear incident in the world, including Chernobyl, Fukushima, Nevada test site, etc.
Well, when you hear that truth and so many more about what actually happened as a result of the Trinity atomic bomb test, you begin to understand that we are all downwinders, stuck in that terrible nuclear seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we look at the second of two deadly anniversaries in atomic and nuclear history. Last week, it was the Church Rock Uranium Tailings Pond Spill of July 16, 1997. And this week, the Trinity test of the first atomic bomb, which took place also on July 16, this time in 1945, near Alamogordo, New Mexico. We'll talk with Tina Cordova, co-founder of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, about the multi-generational impact of Trinity's radioactivity on those such as her family who lived downwind of Trinity. And we'll hear from Joni Ahrens of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety on exactly what nuclear issues the state of New Mexico still faces, even as Los Alamos officially celebrates the creation of the most deadly technology on Earth. Today is Tuesday, July 21st, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective.
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out a week.
I hope you've got a strong stomach. Lisa Gordon Haggerty, who leads the National Nuclear Security Administration that oversees the nation's nuclear programs, has said that the Trinity test that detonated the first atomic bomb 75 years ago led to great progress in science, national defense, and even peacekeeping. A direct quote, "I hope I can impart how it contributed to the betterment of humanity." Oh, what betterment? Like 200,000 dead from the blasts in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, radiation deaths that follow and continue to this day, the release of deadly radioactive plutonium with a half-life of 24,000 years. How does that contribute to the betterment of humanity and peacekeeping, Lisa Gordon Haggerty? Because the only thing I see it contributing to is making you this week's
nuclear hot seat, none that's out a week.
And as a footnote, there were 23 new active cases of COVID-19 this week at National Nuclear Security Administration sites, the second consecutive week of double-digit increases. Of course, the NNSA does not specify the locations where the new cases were reported because the less you know, the less you can do about it. Here's this week's special on the aftermath of the Trinity atomic bomb test, which happened on July 16, 1945, and marks the start of the atomic age. First, we talk with Tina Cordova. She is a Trinity downwinder who grew up in the Tularosa Basin, 40 miles from the explosion of the first atomic bomb in 1945. In 2005, she co-founded the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium. We spoke on Saturday, July 18, 2020.
Tina Cordova, it is so good to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's great to be with you, Libby. And I'm very grateful that you've taken an interest in our story, because it's a story that should be told and that as many people as can hear it should hear it. So I'm grateful and glad to be here.
Now, you are clearly too young to have been alive when the Trinity test took place. So tell us about your family's background. Where did they live? How close they were to the blast site? And a little about what their lives were like before the Trinity blast.
You're absolutely right. I was born in 1959, so much later than the Trinity test. But my family has, I can trace my family back about seven generations in the Tularosa Basin. My father was a four-year-old child living in the little village of Tularosa, about 40 miles the way the crows fly from the test site. At that time, my mother was not living in Tularosa. Her family had lived there, moved away, and then moved back, but my mother wasn't there on the day of the test. My grandmothers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers, most of my family, aunts, uncles, many, many relatives were living there at the time. And our history with the test is that I have been told for many, many years the stories that were passed down in my family about the day of the event and what my elders, my grandmothers, my grandfathers remembered about the test. And that basically there was this explosion that the sky lit up like daylight before daylight, and that this explosion rocked the village, and that for days afterwards, an ash fell from the sky. It's a story that gets repeated over and over by people who were alive at the time and can tell the story now, although those people are few and far between. And when the ash fell from the sky, it became, unfortunately, a part of the environment that the people so depended on for their life, and their livelihood. And obviously, it had devastating consequences. I try to remind people that life in one of those rural communities in 1945 was very organic. First of all, we didn't have running water, so we depended on the rain that fell from the sky to charge up, fill up our cisterns, our lakes, our rivers, our creeks, our ditches, our holding ponds, where people went and utilized those sources for their entire water source. And that meant they're drinking, they're bathing, they're cleaning, they're doing laundry, they're cooking source for water. It also became part of the environment in a way that had far-reaching consequences, because there were no grocery stores. No one had refrigeration. So you couldn't go to a grocery store and buy dairy. You couldn't buy meat. You couldn't buy produce. All of those things you produced yourself. So people had gardens, they had orchards, they had a local dairy, or they had their own cow for the purpose of milk and also for the purpose of protein. And they raised chickens, pigs, sheep, goats. We hunted small mammals and birds. We gathered, hunted, grew, raised everything that we ate. And now that was entirely negatively impacted by the ash that fell from the sky and obviously contaminated everything. We were maximally exposed. There's basically three routes of exposure: inhalation, ingestion, and absorption, and we were maximally exposed. We received all of those. And I always tell people also, don't forget that if you don't have running water, you don't bathe as often. So if that ash got on your skin or in your hair, it likely remained there for many, many days until you had a chance to bathe. Mm-hmm. And so the people were maximally exposed.
What were you told at the time had actually happened? And what were you led to believe the ash that was falling, this gray ash, was all about?
We were told nothing beforehand, and we were told very little afterwards. At the time of the test, the government had basically concocted multiple stories that would be released through the press, depending on what the outcome was, which is very crazy when you think about it. The final story that they utilized in the news a few days after the test was that an ammunition dump out on the missile range had exploded and that there was no loss of life and no damage done. But the thing that everybody also has to remember, in 1945, no one had a television. There were few people that had radios. There were newspapers printed, usually once a week. They got distributed and shared. People didn't have access to information. So for many, many people, they didn't know what had happened. And it was huge. It was enormous. I mean, it knocked people out of their beds in the morning. People told me they thought it was the end of the world and that their mother made them all drop to their knees and start praying the rosary because they were certain it was the end of the world. And people were left with PTSD, by the way, as a result of this. It broke people's windows, it cracked their walls, everything fell out of the cupboards. I mean, it was enormous. And if you and I experienced something like that right now, we could get on the internet and we'd know within minutes what just took place. And then after the bombings that took place on August 6th and 9th in Japan, the government did finally admit that they had tested a device in the desert of New Mexico that produced the bombs that they took to Japan. That still meant nothing to anybody.
Part of that, it was intentional. When you mentioned the multiple press releases that were written, they were actually written by an embedded reporter from the New York Times, a man named William L. Lawrence, who I know you have cited for some of his other writing, but he was the one who wrote the range of press releases, everything from, oh, nothing happened, to we're evacuating the state now. He knew about radioactivity. There was nothing in there. And then after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he's the one who wrote the majority of articles that came out about it. And again, completely eliminated any mention of radiation or radioactivity. So there was no sense of the long-term damage that was done. Now, in terms of that long-term damage to health, when did that start showing up, and when did people start connecting that with the gray ash that fell from the bomb going off, from the test?
Before I get into that, let me just say that the government counted very heavily on the people who lived in the area to be uneducated, unsophisticated, and unable to stick up for themselves, even after they came back and said that there might be radiation. I know there's a story in the literature that I've read many times about one of the ranchers who encountered some of these soldiers that came back to take a look at the radiation on his ranch. And he said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "We're checking for radioactivity." And he said, "You won't find any here. We don't have the radio turned on." And so there was no understanding of what this meant. But your question in regards to when did the disease manifestation start? In 1955, both of my great-grandfathers died from what they called stomach cancer. And that was at a time when no one in these little towns had ever heard the word cancer. And it was a terrible, terrible thing because they didn't have treatment. People didn't have insurance. There certainly was no access to health care in the little town that I grew up in. There was no way to be diagnosed there. There was no treatment. People even wondered if they could catch this from people who had it. And so my great-grandfather suffered a great deal before they died. They were, I believe, put on morphine from the stories I was told. And they basically laid in a bed and died a few months after they started to get sick. But no one was putting it together as related to the bomb. And people continue to die. I'm a thyroid cancer survivor. And when I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer, the first thing they asked me was, "When were you exposed to radiation? Did you work with radioactive isotopes? Did you work in a lab? Did you ever work in an x-ray facility? Have you had a lot of x-rays?" But I will tell you the truth. I started to connect these dots when I was in college. I have a degree in the sciences, and I started to realize the reason there's so many people in my community sick and dying is because we were overexposed to radiation. It has to be that. And people started talking about it, but you have to also realize that you don't bite the hand that feeds you. And the government did an incredible job of controlling the messaging always. Yes. For example, they said the area was remote and uninhabited, but in reality, tens of thousands of people lived in a 50-mile radius. And per their own admission, they said, "We can never do this here again because we've so overexposed people to radiation. And if we do it again, we have to find an area with a 150-mile radius uninhabited." They went to Nevada to establish that. But if you draw a radius around Trinity, 150 miles, it encompasses Albuquerque to the north and past El Paso to the south and to almost our eastern and western border in New Mexico. That's our entire state. So now you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that were exposed. The other thing that the government did a really good job of is creating the idea inside of these communities that we should be proud of the fact that we participated in this event that brought an end to the war. And for some people, that was important. A lot of people, that was very important because, number one, their husbands, their brothers were off serving in the Pacific. So this was going to put an end to that and bring these men home. And not only that, but these facilities, these government facilities, employ a lot of people. And I have to tell you, on more than one occasion, people have told me, you keep this up and they're going to close those bases and we're not going to have jobs. And I've said, that'll never happen. That will never happen. And we can't be fearful of those sorts of things, but that will never happen. Our government doesn't have the resources to reestablish that bombing range that's the largest any place, that has the largest airspace any place in the world. And so they made us fear for our jobs. They made us feel some level of pride because we were, in my mind, enlisted into the service of our country without consent or knowledge. And then they minimized it. Oh, it's remote and uninhabited. Oh, nobody was affected. And the fact that the government never came back also gave this sense that there was no reason to come back. It wasn't dangerous. Nothing happened that could possibly have caused problems. But people always talked about, why are there so many of us sick? Why are so many of us dying? And it wasn't until 15 years ago when we started our work that people just started coming out of the woodwork and saying, you know what? I knew this all along. I thought this all along. It has to be, you know, everybody in my family's gone now. Everybody's sick, and now it's affecting my children and my grandchildren. And so, you know, everybody now has embraced this, now understands it to be true. And now science is in our favor as well.
So let's roll this back slightly as to how you made the connection from being in college and studying the sciences and starting to become aware to this time 15 years ago when you founded the group, and we'll explain about that too. But how did you take that journey to enough realization that you helped with the founding of the Tularosa Basin Consortium?
So I read an article in the Reader's Digest about the Nevada test site downwinders. And this probably happened, I would say, at least a good 20, maybe 22 years ago that I read this article. And I saved it because I the minute I read it, I said, this is us. This is us. And this now explains, and it also explains the fact that there are other people trying to be recognized. And then I read a letter to the editor in the newspaper from back home from a gentleman who said, I'd lived my whole career away from here, and now I'm back to retire. And my mother just died after having three cancers, and everybody is sick and dying, and when are we going to hold the government accountable? And I knew this gentleman. He was older than I. I didn't go to school with him. I went to school with some of his brothers and sisters. But I knew him, and I contacted him. I said, Fred, we have to do something about this because it is absolutely the truth. And there are downwinders in other parts of the country as well. And I've read about this, and I've done some loose research on it. And I know, because of the science that I know and understand, it had to have had an effect on us. And so we started the organization and then immediately started doing a lot of research. And that really did lead to a realization of how this could have potentially been so devastating for the people who lived 12. I always say we've identified ranchers that live 12 miles away. Imagine that. But the people that lived in communities, you know, 12, 15, 20, 30, 40 miles away. I mean, those people have basically for 75 years been relegated to nothingness. We've counted for nothing. I had somebody tell me one time, we're not even guinea pigs because they check back on guinea pigs. And I said, you know what? That's like the most profound thing. I never even thought of it in those terms. They didn't even consider us to be test subjects because they've never come back to check on us.
So has there been any kind of government testing or epidemiology or checking into this to try and find out what the impact actually was?
No epidemiological studies have ever been done, which is incredibly unfortunate because our government could probably at this point understand a whole lot more than they ever have about the effects of radiation on the human body. And not just on the human body, but on your genetics and how that affects future generations, right? It may be because nobody really wants to know the truth about that. But having said all that, there are only two things that I know about. The Los Alamos Historic Document Retrieval and Assessment, or LHADRA project, which was a 10-year project paid for by the Department of Energy, requested by Congress as a result of the people in New Mexico wanting to know what were the releases from Los Alamos as they developed and did the little bit of testing that they did in Los Alamos. The elephant in the room as they conducted that 10-year test was the Trinity site. And we know now, because one of the primary investigators, Dr. Joseph Shanka, has now challenged the false narrative that exists that nobody lived here and nobody was harmed. And he has extrapolated, taking what he knows from those 10-year study that he did on LHADRA, he's taken the information that he had access to there, extrapolated knowing what we now know about the type of blast that it was at Trinity, and everything else, and said that the people in New Mexico were exposed to somewhere between 10 and 100 times more radiation than anyone ever has been from any other nuclear incident in the world, including Chernobyl, Fukushima, Nevada test site, etc., which is mind-boggling. Try wrapping your mind around that. That study, the LHADRA study in chapter 10, clearly states that the CDC believes that the exposures the day of the blast could have been as much as 10,000 times what's considered acceptable today to some of the population that lived in the vicinity to the test site. That is unforgivable.
How long ago was that test? How long ago were those results found?
That report was published, I want to say, in 2015, 5 years ago. And there was actually some, the CDC actually put forward recommendations that they thought someone, the government, should follow up on. And there were a number of recommendations around the Trinity test site. And most of those recommendations have fallen on deaf ears. And after spending, I believe the entire process was over $10 million. And to not follow up on the recommendations is insanity. Above and beyond that, though, the National Institute of Health has been conducting a dose reconstruction that they started, I want to say, 5 years ago. And the dose reconstruction, we've had very little to count on. In the beginning of this dose reconstruction, they consulted closely with members of the community for specific reasons, to help them get the tribal entities to invite them to come here and do this, which they absolutely had to have to move forward with the study. We delivered those statements from the tribal entities. We also helped them develop their questions that they would ask. But imagine trying to conduct a dose reconstruction 70 to 75 years later, depending on people's recollections when they're somewhere older than 70 years old. When they first came here, they told us, and I remember this very distinctly, that they wouldn't consider anybody to participate unless they had been 13 years or older at the time of the test so that they would have some real recollection. And I said, those people don't exist anymore because they've all died from cancer. I mean, you're never going to find people like what you're looking for. They're so few and far between. And if you find any people like that that you can recognize, you won't have enough of them for this study to be considered scientific. But anyway, having said all that, they moved ahead with this dose reconstruction. And I've had many scientists that I count on, that I trust, who have amazing reputations, have told me it's impossible to do a dose reconstruction this far down, you know, this late in the history of the incident, in other words. So they relaxed their qualifications and said, if you were alive at the time. So I know somebody that was born 8 days before the bomb. They would consider her somebody they could rely on. But she doesn't remember what life was like in 1945, where she got water or how her family got food. And actually, when you think about it, everything changed dramatically after the war because our government then put all the money into infrastructure and building the infrastructure in our country. And now we had running water and we had refrigeration because we had electricity, et cetera. And so things changed dramatically. The woman I know who was born 8 days before the bomb, she wouldn't remember that they gathered water from a cistern or that they got their milk from a milk cow necessarily. And then the other thing we know about is that this last summer, a year ago, there was an article published in a scientific journal about how we had a huge spike in infant mortality in the months right after the Trinity test.
That's the Bob Alvarez, Kitty Tucker research that was done.
Absolutely. And many, many thanks to Kitty Tucker and Bob Alvarez. Kitty is the one that contacted the New Mexico Department of Health and received the information many, many years ago. And she sat on it for many years because she wasn't, I don't think, certain how she would use that information or where, when it might become important. But they published those findings. And what's absolutely unforgivable about it is that when the Manhattan Project was contacted by a healthcare worker from New Mexico and asked what could explain the infant mortality that we're seeing. We're losing babies. We hear it's worse. This woman was from Roswell, New Mexico. She said, we hear it's worse in Alamogordo. And she said, it doesn't seem to matter what we do. We can't keep these babies alive. And the Manhattan Project decided to deny. And they basically said, we've looked at the statistics and the statistics don't show that. And that is an absolute lie. Because Kitty Tucker has the Department of Health statistics that show that in those months following Trinity, after a steady 10-year decline in infant mortality, because of the advent of antibiotics, medical practices, hygienic practices, keeping babies alive changed dramatically. But having said all that, they decided to deny and lie and look the other way, and we had casualties from Trinity. They were babies. They were children. And that's just unforgivable.
And that was the infant mortality rate that spiked in the months, in the certainly in August of 1945, and beyond that for the next few months.
That's correct. From August through October, we saw these huge increases. And knowing what we know about radiation exposure now, that would make perfect sense, because your exposure to radiation is a factor of distance and time. One of the reasons why we were so overexposed, because we lived so much closer. Your exposure is also based on your body mass. So if you're a child or a baby, because you have a smaller body mass, you would have received a higher dose exposure. It all makes sense. And it's not outside of reason to be able to draw a conclusion. It's probably what they saw, and I'm not an expert on this, but I'll bet most of what I have that it's the same thing they saw in Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the bombings in August. The babies that were alive at that point couldn't sustain the radiation doses, and they probably had babies die as a result.
It's significant that after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that there was no real study, no real epidemiology done until it was started 5 years later, meaning the earliest of the deaths and the most severe rate of death would have already been long past. So at 5 years, they picked it up, and that's the Hibakusha study that's been going on since.
Yeah, and how unfortunate, because if you want to know the truth, and if you want to get at the truth, then especially as it relates to this sort of an issue, you take that up almost immediately so that you can understand the full scope of the impact.
Let's take a look now at the work that is being done, is still being done, by the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium that you helped to found and that is still ongoing. Where are you focusing your efforts these days?
Our entire focus these days is on getting the amendments to the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act passed. The amendments, specifically those in House Bill 3783, would extend compensation to the people of New Mexico for the first time ever. That fund has been in place for 30 years, and we've never been included. We were the first people exposed to radiation any place in the world, and how we were left out, I always say, is the $2.3 billion question. That's what's been paid out in compensation so far.
Now, who is included in that? Does that include the Navajo uranium miners?
It includes the Nevada test downwinders. And let me also state, this is something that's very important to the history of all this. New Mexico was downwind of the Nevada test site. That is very well documented. When the government did the testing in Nevada, they put up monitors in different states, and one of them was New Mexico. It's very well documented that through the summer of 1962, when they did above ground testing, New Mexico received radiation exposure because of that. But the compensation stops right at the Arizona-New Mexico border, as if there's some lead curtain there that offers us protection. So I always say, if you live 5 feet over that border to one side, you get compensated. If you live 5 feet over that border to the other side, you do not. That's how unjust this is. But it includes uranium miners, and there are many of them in New Mexico, but only if you mined uranium before 1971. If you mined uranium after 1971, you're not included, because that's when uranium became publicly available for the use in the production of energy, for example. And so the government said, we're no longer going to accept responsibility for the damage that's done to human health, because that'll take care of itself, you know, private industry, which you well know never, ever happens. So we have all of these miners that continue to work in the uranium mining industry that aren't taken care of. And it's such a very sad history for them, because you might have a gentleman that lives on one side of the street being compensated and a gentleman that lives on the other side of the street not compensated. And, you know, I've been to these communities. They often ask me to come speak about the downwinders. And I can't believe the stories I hear there, just like I can't believe the stories I hear in the downwind communities about people having to hold bake sales so they can buy their pain medication. Or the uranium miner that I heard speak in Laguna Pueblo, who said, my wife walks the Pueblo every week and asks people to gift us money so we can put gas in our car to get me to Albuquerque so I can get my treatment. That is also unforgivable. And so the fund now takes care of the downwinders from Nevada, and it includes people in parts of Nevada, Utah, Colorado, and Arizona. Nobody from New Mexico. And then men and women who worked in the uranium mining industry before 1971.
With the work that you're doing in trying to move this forward, and now that we have hit the 75th anniversary of the start of the atomic age, when all these horrors began, there's been a lot of media coverage, both rah-rah nukes and talking about how deadly the test was and the radioactivity. With this bump in visibility, I know that your group was attempting to put together an event that unfortunately COVID took down, but you still put together a video. Tell us about that video and what it consists of.
So part of our goal has always been to educate as many people about this issue as possible. And our in-person annual candlelight vigil is a beautiful cathartic event that we developed 10 years ago to offer support and comfort to those people who've lost loved ones and to forever memorialize them, their names. I always said, if the government's not going to come back and care one bit about these people, it's our job and our duty, because they are our families and our friends, to make sure that at least once a year, their name is acknowledged, because they were true patriots that literally gave up their lives in service of our country. And so we have this annual candlelight vigil. We light what's called Illuminatia, a paper sack with a candle in it, and we call out their names. Well, because this year we couldn't do that, we decided to put together a video that we could share widely. And it's been seen all over the world, actually. Mm-hmm. And the video consists of us giving an explanation of the Trinity test and what made it so devastating to human health. And then a group of very brave individuals have told their own family experiences with the sacrifice and suffering. And then our elected officials who support us, we have huge support from our governor, our lieutenant governor, and our entire congressional delegation. And then they all came forward with videos. Well, we received videos from everybody except the two senators who were unable to actually participate. But then as a follow-on to all of that, we read the names of those people as part of our video. And you can't watch this and not have those names are provided to us by family and friends of these people who died. We add names, many, 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 many names every year. Hmm. And it's through a voluntary process. I always say that if we went door to door in these communities, we wouldn't call out, you know, 800 and some odd names. We would call out thousands of names. It would take us probably the better part of 4 or 5 hours to list all the names. It's a wonderful video. We're very proud of how it all came together. The other reason I think it's important for us to remind people about the effects of testing is because there's been this idea floated recently in our country that maybe we should resume testing of nuclear devices. And I always say that what they tell you is it's perfectly safe. And it is until the moment it's not. And then when it's not, it's catastrophic. And if you think somebody is going to come back out of the goodness of who they are to take care of you, think again, because we've been appealing to their better angels for 10 years now. There have been bills entered into Congress to add us to the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which we so much deserve. And for 10 years, they've looked the other way. But for 75 years, they've chosen to unacknowledge the suffering and sacrifice that the people of New Mexico experienced. So if there is a catastrophic event, don't ever think somebody's going to come back and take care of it. It's not going to happen.
So we're at the 75th anniversary, and right now is the lull between when the Trinity test happened and then the dropping of the bombs on Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. With this bump of visibility that the issues have gotten, that Trinity has gotten, what can you do, and what can the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat do to help you benefit from the visibility and from the awareness, fleeting though it is in the news cycle, to be able to help you gain the compensation that you believe you deserve?
First of all, everybody out there has somebody who represents them in Congress, in the House and in the Senate. And the first thing that people can do is contact their members of Congress, wherever they are, and let them know that they support House Bill 3783 and the passage of that bill, and that it is high time that that bill is passed. The thing they tell us year after year about these bills is that they don't have the money to add us to the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. Can you imagine the insult that is added to the injury by saying something so incredibly without compassion or empathy? You know, like I said, we've been appealing to their better angels, and that is the result of appealing to their better angels. If people start contacting Congress and their members of Congress and start putting this on their radar screen, then this bill will gain momentum. The other thing that they can ask their members of Congress to do is to become co-signers to these bills. Both bills have bipartisan support. The Senate bill is 947. Now, we're glad to have the Senate bill introduced. It doesn't go far enough. It needs to coincide with House Bill 3783. But people need to contact their members of Congress in the House and the Senate, ask them to become co-signers to these bills, ask them to fully support these bills. And we won't take the excuse any longer that there's not money for this when they're passing trillion-dollar bills in relief of COVID, which I fully understand and we know are necessary. But when they have political will to do these things, they do them. They do them. And so when you have a defense bill every year that's in the trillions, when you have the idea of building more plutonium pits and money going into doing those sorts of things, there certainly is money to fund and take care of the problems that exist from the past. And we're not going to settle for that excuse any longer.
Tina, is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to mention at this time?
I just want to express to people how grateful we are for the support we have received. I am so grateful for the exposure from the 75th anniversary, but it has to be this exposure this knowledge that people have gained because of everything that they know about the Trinity downwinders, they have to take action on this. You know, the average person has to take action on this. And what I mean by that is that if you become complacent in these types of issues, you're then complicit. And the truth of the matter is, this is nothing more than a moral and an ethical issue. There's a moral and an ethical issue to right this wrong and to extend justice to the people of New Mexico. And I just want to say that we are grateful for the support, and we hope that everybody out there will be moved to become active in this fight. We need people from all across the country to do outreach to Washington, D.C., and make sure that their representatives understand how important it is.
Tina, we will, of course, link to your website on nuclearhotseat.com under this episode. We will also have the video up and other information that we think is going to be relevant so that they can continue this. For now, I was deeply moved by the video. I'm deeply moved by your passion and your focus and your drive and what you've been able to accomplish thus far. And I'm extremely grateful that we found the time for you to be my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, I thank you, and I know that you reach a lot of people, and these are people who are activists by nature, and we identify with each other, and I just appreciate this opportunity greatly. Thank you so much.
Tina Cordova of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium. We'll have links to the website and support material for your letters to elected officials up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, this episode, number 474. We'll continue with this week's special program, acknowledging the world's first atomic bomb blast 75 years ago, in just a moment. But first, nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert, the framework of international treaties demolished, COVID compromises to safety at nuclear facilities, the seeming inevitability of a new arms race, and now the official rah-rah pro-nuclear propaganda push, linked with the 75th anniversary of the Trinity test and the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The nuclear industry just loves its talking points as it keeps pushing onward, intent upon gobbling up money for the few and polluting human resources for everyone else, yes, including you. We are facing a wider range of nuclear dangers than ever before, and the only way to fight against them is to know what's going on and what you can do to change things. That is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We look at the nuclear aspect of our world every week, and especially now with the coronavirus wreaking havoc on safety at reactors, weapons manufacturing sites, and with the radioactive waste. You are not going to be getting this information from mainstream media. Nuclear Hot Seat is the only place you can count on to report the ongoing, evolving nuclear truth about weapons, waste, uranium mining, and the COVID nuclear connection. To keep this show running takes time, energy, effort, and funding. But COVID has hit us as hard as anyone, which makes your help to keep the show going more important than ever. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to help us with a donation of any size. And that same red button is now where you can send a monthly $5, the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. Please do what you can now, and know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now back to this week's special on the aftermath of the Trinity atomic bomb test in New Mexico in 1945. Joni Ahrens is one of the founders of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety, based in New Mexico. We previously spoke with this long-term accident for Nuclear Hot Seat number 443 from December 17, 2019. That was for Joni's toxic tour of New Mexico. Here, she enumerates the ongoing nuclear problems facing New Mexico. We spoke on Saturday, July 18, 2020.
Joni Ahrens, always a pleasure to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. It's so nice to be with you this afternoon.
Solemn occasion that we are sharing here, which is the commemoration of Trinity. But first, I think it's important for people to understand how extensively New Mexico is involved with the nuclear fuel chain.
Yes. New Mexico has every piece of the nuclear fuel chain in it. The uranium cycle begins with uranium mining in the Grants Uranium Belt on the western side of the state. And then the Atomic Energy Commission came to New Mexico and established Los Alamos National Laboratory in 1943. And at that point, they removed the homesteaders who lived on the Pajarito Plateau by gunpoint. And they established the laboratory to design and build the first nuclear weapons. Los Alamos National Laboratory continues to fabricate nuclear weapons, design and fabricate nuclear weapons on the Pajarito Plateau. There are new plans to expand the manufacture, the fabrication of the plutonium pits. The Trump administration has funded $1 billion a year from $2 billion a year to be able to do this work. So we have nuclear weapons. Then we have WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, which is in the southeastern part of the state. And that is for only defense-related wastes that are plutonium contaminated. And it's important to know about weapons-grade plutonium because it needs to be isolated from the environment for 250,000 years. Its half-life is 24,000 years times 10 half-lives is 250,000 years, roughly. And human exposure is through ingestion and inhalation. It causes cancer. It's scheduled to close in 2024, but there are proposals to expand the capacity at WIP by who knows what, because they want to keep it open until 2080. Their state hazardous waste permit is up for renewal this year, and the closing date for WIP, which is now 2024, is going to be a really big fight. And we need people around the country and around the world to know about what's going on, because WIP was never supposed to be the only waste dump for this kind of waste. Then we have the New Mexico ratepayers are invested in the Palo Verde nuclear power plant. Then we have 10 long-term stewardship sites, which means sites that the Department of Energy have designated as long-term stewardship sites. And what long-term stewardship means is that they're never going to clean it up. And then we have, besides the Trinity test in 1945, we have the gas buggy experiment, which was for freeing natural gas from the geological formation. That one was in 1967, and the gas became radioactive as a result of that, and it vented for weeks into the air, into the environment. There's also a site in the southeastern part of the state near WIP called the Nome and Coach experiment that they did that also has been a tragic situation. So these three tests were with a nuclear weapon. And now there are two proposals to bring all of the high-level waste, all of the spent fuel rods from around the entire country, plus future waste from nuclear power plants to New Mexico and the Texas-New Mexico border. The comment periods are open right now to provide comments on their draft environmental impact statement. The first proposal is called Holtec International, and that's for the site that's 16 miles north of the WIP site. The other proposal is to expand waste control specialists, now called interim storage partners, which is located right on the Texas-New Mexico border, 5 miles east of Eunice, New Mexico. Both draft environmental impact statements are open for public comment. You can learn more information at our website at nuclearactive.org.
It sounds almost like New Mexico has been set up as a nuclear sacrifice zone for the entire country.
Exactly. And we have to fight back. We are fighting back against this. You have to know that in New Mexico, our state budget is about $7 billion. And the Department of Energy at Sandia National Laboratory in Albuquerque, Los Alamos and the waste isolation pilot plant equals about $7 billion. Just to give you an idea of the balance, if there is a balance, and the amount of power that the Department of Energy has right now. With regard to the high-level waste interim storage proposals, the governor, the land commissioner, and other officials have provided written statements in opposition to those projects. But the expansion of PIP production at Los Alamos National Laboratory and the expansion of the waste isolation pilot plant, they are supporting those things. So we have this conflict about opposing high-level waste coming to New Mexico. But if I can speculate, having $1 billion on the table for expanded PIP production at Los Alamos means that they have to expand WIP in order to have a place to dispose of the waste. But there's also five other proposals for WIP, including surplus plutonium from the Savannah River site to bring it to WIP, the high-level waste from West Valley in New York, and future nuclear waste that will be generated by PIT production. So there's a lot of potential for these projects to go forward because there's a lot of money on the table. But the people are organizing. We're doing a lot of work and bringing groups that we haven't necessarily worked with before together to oppose these projects. I also want to add that the oil and gas industry is very concerned about these proposals because they're located in the Permian Basin where they're making a huge amount of money pumping natural gas and oil in that area. So the Fasken Ranch Company, oil and gas company, is opposing the Holtec project before the NRC right now. We've never worked with the gas and oil.
I was about to say strange bedfellows or bed sisters on that one.
Yes.
Now, I want to shift this because we are still in the immediate wake of the anniversary, the commemoration, the memorial of the Trinity nuclear blast, the first atomic blast that ever took place on the planet. And if there is a ground zero for this, it's Los Alamos. This is where the rah-rah nuksters come to pat each other on the back and say, wow, wasn't this wonderful? And isn't the A-bomb terrific? So I'm wondering, we have COVID going on. What did that do? What was it like in Los Alamos with Trinity's anniversary being just this past week?
The head of the National Nuclear Security Administration came to Los Alamos to cut a ribbon to commemorate the Trinity test. But the way that it's reported and in the NNSA's press releases, she was praising the scientists and the scientific achievements that resulted from the Manhattan Project. She did not talk about all of the harm that has occurred through the generations to the people and families that were overexposed to radiation in 1945. It didn't sound like she called Tina Cordova and said, I'm so sorry. DOE did not make a statement. DOE and NNSA did not make a statement that says, we're going to support expansion of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. They did not do that. But those are things that they could have done in commemoration of all of the harm that they've inflicted on New Mexico.
That's why I refer to the rah-rah nukers, because they don't want to accept responsibility for the harm they did. They just want to continue with the game of my bang's bigger than your bang, and let's make even more of them.
Yes.
So with the anniversaries of Hiroshima and Nagasaki coming up in early August, what else is either planned for Los Alamos or planned by your organization and others to continue the visibility of the damage that was done by this program, the ongoing damage of it, and see what can be done to stop any more production and perhaps turn it around?
There are many things happening in New Mexico, in the United States of America, and around the world. We've been working with the Pace e Bene group, which means peace and good. They are based in California, and they do their annual event in Los Alamos. And so we had been planning the 3-day event with a conference, and Vets for Peace was holding its national convention in Albuquerque, and we had buses scheduled to take people from Albuquerque up to Los Alamos. And then COVID hit, and then we moved to a virtual presentation. So we have a 1 hour that begins at 6 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time on August 6th. And it's going to be inserted into the national and international Hiroshima Nagasaki 75 organizing event. The website is HN75. And then they're also doing an event on August 9th. CCNS has prepared a list of events. It's 2.5 pages right now, and it has a lot of the articles that happened from Trinity as well, a listing of articles. And we'll be updating it. And again, our website is nuclearactive.org. When I think about COVID and I think of one blessing, it's that we're all coming together and we have a unified message, and more people are getting involved. And the young people.
Ooh, yay! Yes, young people!
Joni Ahrens of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety. And I join with her in celebrating our next generation of activists. We'll have our links up to the work of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, this episode, number 474.
Activist shout out.
A reminder that HiroshimaNagasaki75.org is going to present 2 full days of live stream programming on August 6th and 9th, the anniversaries of the dropping of the atomic bombs by the United States on Japan in 1945. We will have a link on this week's site to the list of participants, which is extensive and international. I'm honored that I will have partaken in 2 of the pieces. And I'll let you know more about that as the schedule is confirmed. If you want to know more, go to HiroshimaNagasaki75.org and check it out. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. Thanks to all of you for listening, and a big shout out to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners, followers, and supporters around the world in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. If you haven't already done so, go to Nuclear Hot Seat's Facebook page, like it, share it. Let's just share this all over the internet. And if you understand any of the other social media platforms, please contact me. I don't, and I could use some help. You can find Nuclear Hot Seat on all your favorite podcast listening programs. Or if you'd like to make certain that you never miss a single episode, go to nuclearhotseat.com and scroll down to the yellow opt-in box. Fill in your first name and an email address, and you will get the show via email every week with a brief description of what is in the show. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world and special interviews with those people on the front lines, take a moment to go to nuclearhotseat.com. Look for that big red button and do what you can to help, because anything will be of assistance. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020 Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that as former Soviet Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev famously said of the aftermath of a nuclear war, the living will envy the dead. If that's not a nuclear wake-up call, I don't know what is. So now don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.